Vita Voices and Views is brought to you by Vita, Women in the Literary Arts, with host and executive producer Melissa Studdard and executive producer digital media R.J. Jeffries.
Beloved poet and poetry magazine editor Dawn Scher was a 2015 recipient of Vita's Vito Award for his contributions to American literature and literary community. In addition to being the author and editor of over a dozen books, Scher is an accomplished translator whose renditions of Miguel Hernandez were awarded the Times Literary Supplement Translation Prize and the Premio Valle in Cannes. As well, Scher's work at Poetry has been recognized with 3 National Magazine Awards for editorial excellence from the American Society of Magazine Editors and a CLMP Firecracker Award for Best Poetry Magazine. Scher is celebrated in the literary community for his generosity, innovativeness, and warm wit.
Food for thought. Never weaned from anger. The stars incline but do not require. Left alone, she thinks hard. Thoughts mean as snow at harvest. Home is paradise to cats. Hell for wives, she thinks. Are all babies slippery? Boys hate old men, but women despise them, she thinks. Bed full of bones. And bad usage aggravates the matter. She had a smack of this disease. Like Vulcan, he made creaking shoes for his Venus. That is to say, being bloodthirsty, nature turns leaves red every single thaw, and she thinks love more violent. Even Noah, Jerome says, showed his nakedness and his drunkenness, which for 600 years he had covered in his soberness. So, what can she do with his scores of years for scruples? The sailor doesn't see the water passing underneath his ship. The fisherman, all the fish deep in the sea around his nets. So she thinks, nothing will ever be my own, not even time. And feeds herself more thoughts, the way ravens fed Elijah. Invisible, invisible, invisible.
Thank you. It does exactly what I was talking about earlier.
Well, it's kind of an angry poem. I'm not the one who's angry. I mean, mm-hmm. It's kind of the experience that women have when they must raise children, give birth, mm-hmm. raise children, hold down. If you look all over the world, the images in the most troubled places, you see women having to pay the price for the violence that occurs, whether it's domestic violence or warfare or poverty. It's women who have to convert all kinds of emotions and disadvantages into a world that makes it possible for somebody else to survive. And that's the hardest work known to us.
Well, I think the one of the reasons that this poem did appeal to me so much is that, what you were saying about that it's not you who's angry. I mean, I think there's an incredible amount of compassion that has to go into a poem like this, and which is from a totally different viewpoint than your own. And it is something that I see a lot in your work. I mean, there's the perspective which we'll get to Wishbone in a minute. I'm actually going to have you read a different poem from that collection, but in the actual title poem, Wishbone, you've got the cat, right?
And
that empathy, you know, it's a really amazing thing. And it really spoke to me as a woman too. Not to disparage child rearing or anything, because that's been really the greatest thing that's ever happened to me was to have a daughter. But between being a single mom and holding down a full-time job and trying to also write and do the things that I'm personally passionate about outside of the family life and, you know, interviews and all the things that I love
right.
and have to do, that feeling that your time is not your own.
And your life is not your own, and your thoughts are not your own. Yeah.
Pardon me?
your life isn't your own, your thoughts aren't your own, your body isn't your own. I mean, there's so much sacrifice there. And any man, you know, with any humanity senses that. I think it's striking that if you look at visual artworks that depict a pietà, there's always the, you know, sort of mother peering into the infant's face, and it's the great tenderness that's there is really powerful, but it's belied by the fact of holding a baby. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where the thing about babies being slippery, which of course they are, and you have to learn, you know, how to, it happens quick, but the first time you hold your own baby, it's an education that no art prepares you for, it seems mm-hmm. to me. And so the sort of texture of the physical relationships that we all have to keep the world going was another kind of aspect of what I was trying to think through there. How, mm-hmm. on the one hand, it's instinctive and therefore almost simple, but it's really complicated. I mean, it's an experience that's reinvented every time it happens. Every time somebody holds a child or holds another person in their arms, that experience is recreated. And it's as if that's the level on which our, you know, kind of work in the world has to be, mm-hmm. you know, imagined. And reimagined mm-hmm. continually.
That's just that really, really resonates with me. I mean, I love what you're saying about how it's like it's reinvented each time, and there is that feeling when you're a parent, like when you're a new parent and you have your baby for the first time, and you're feeling like this is. Like I'm inventing fire here. This is something totally yeah. new, but at the same time, it's like the oldest thing, you know, in humanity is that we reproduce, right? I mean, we're connected that way. So, I wanted to ask you also to read a poem from Wishbone, and I have selected for your surprise Eclipse.
Yeah, happy to do that. Another poem I don't think I ever even read out loud to anybody as far as I know, but
oh, that's great.
Here it is, Eclipse. And I actually wrote this for Sandra Simons, who I sent it to ages and ages ago. Eclipse, her comma-like eyebrows, simple legs in milk-white flame plush, directly the night sky, shy of its planets, furrows its distant lemons, and tilts. One of your ancestors must have read a forbidden book.
I love the ending for obvious reasons, but those lemons get me. I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you read this poem, actually, because there are a lot of other poems in the collection that I saw that were praised a lot in reviews that are longer poems, mm-hmm. you know, and it kind of would have been easier to have you read one of those because I understand them better. This one, I think the thing that I like about it is it has almost like a Neruda-like impact on me where I don't necessarily understand why I like certain parts of it so much, like those distant lemons. I mean, and that's the magic of poetry. It's just, I have no idea why I like that so much, but I just love it, you know, just the image.
So, well, yeah, I can't say that I could quite explain it. I mean, it makes intuitive sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, of course, and sort of there's an imaginative logic that needs no explanation because the explanation would be sort of lesser than the whatever the poem manages to accomplish on its own terms. But I mean, you know, I was imagining, again, a person, who that person is, how does a person get to arrive at who they are? Mm-hmm. Where do they come from? From whom do we descend? Mm-hmm. In what kind of simple world, you know, do our origins, you know, arise in? Mm-hmm. I guess I was thinking of a kind of a desert, or then maybe a place where there was a lemon tree, or mm-hmm. forbidden fruit, or forbidden books. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was written for a poet who is pushing boundaries and pushing at so many things. Mm-hmm. And I think that delicious sort of crime of having access to a forbidden book is about the fruit of all knowledge that we have. I mean, it's not a religious poem or anything, but I think we inherit that kind of vocabulary for these mysteries. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was in my mind, that the whole cosmos kind of conspires in a very weird way in its imagination to make us possible. Mm-hmm. So it's also paying tribute, not just, say, to a person, but also to kind of the whole environment that, you know, that makes it possible for us to have our brief existence, during which we try to do, as we were talking about before, noble and essential things.
Yes.
You know, we have that moment, we have a small molecule. It's like a fruit on a tree. It's like one thing, and it doesn't last, but it has its own character and taste and texture and scent and embodiment. And then it's gone, and something else has to grow.
That's gorgeous and sad and everything all at the same time.
Well, it occurred to me, too, with the title Eclipse, you know, they seem such frightful things. And I suppose in history, people, you know, were known to freak out when the sun was blotted out from the sky.
Right.
The great thing about an eclipse is that the light comes back. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of an eclipse as involving darkness, but it involves the light. Mm-hmm. So that when things are eclipsed, if everything's working okay, so far it has, then somewhere the light comes back and the planets like resume their illuminations.
Mm-hmm. That's really beautiful. You know, one of the things about the book, Wishbone, that I kind of want to give people who are watching this a feel for is that you have all of these really wonderful little short, very short poems. I mean, I counted one of them only had like 5 words in it.
Yeah.
It absolutely is a poem. So
I struggle with this a lot as a person who I may read more poems than anybody in the English speaking world, maybe on the planet. I mean, I read all those poems. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to do in my work what I would critique someone else for doing in theirs. Mm-hmm. So it sort of has an inhibiting effect. And at the time I was working on this stuff, I was, you know how you have a poem and you say, well, these parts are good, like mm-hmm. this part's pretty good. And then you try to work up a poem so that it sort of floats the good parts. You're sort of creating a scaffolding. And
right.
then, well, the good parts are here, but here's the rest of the poem. I thought, well, what if you just kicked away the scaffolding and only kept like the heart of the poem and got rid of all the stuff to explain it? And so some of these poems were kind of my attempt to just like peel away the verbiage, because I am, as you can tell, a sort of a chatty person. And my poems can be like that too, where they're sort of chatting and mm-hmm. thinking and talking. And I thought, well, what if we dispensed with all that and just got down to sort of, it would be like the, you know, in some ways you could say that there are poems where they are the punchline without the joke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I'm pretty serious about mm-hmm. poetry, so I will just keep the important lines mm-hmm. and discard everything else that in which they were embedded. Mm-hmm. And some of those poems were that, and I thought it worked okay. I can't tell. I think people sort of thought I was, you know, being glib, mm-hmm. and you know, I think there was, you know, some people I know read them and said, yeah, but to me that was very, I mean, it was, you know, we all talk about compression and condensation and stuff, and I thought, well, you know, when you come right down to it, most poems only have 5 good words in them. In fact, if a poem has 5 good words in it, that's a considerable achievement, right? So I thought I'll just like keep those, throw everything else away. But I may have thrown away too much. I don't know.
I actually like it. And it reminded me of John Yao. You know,
he has
poems like that. And it, like he'll just string them together. And it's the same kind of thing. I mean, there was one that you had. Oh my God, it was so funny. I think the title was in German. Do you mind reading a couple of these? Because I just would. I mean, I don't know. I really like them.
Yeah, the German one. Well, that's another thing too about poetry, where sometimes the title just gives everything away, and we're so good at titles,
right?
That like the rest of the poem is always a bit of a letdown. So this poem really is glib, the one with the German title, but it's, you know, Die Welt ist so verkehrt. My German is terrible. Die Welt is so verkehrt. Sort of like, well, it sounds like, it means what it sounds like, you know, about the world. It's, you know, and you know how every day we experience technological failures that are at, in some ways, are inconveniences, and in some ways they could be quite disastrous. And so, like, this was written before the advent of, I suppose you could say, serious cybercrime. But it occurred to me, you know, that so much of what we have can be kind of hacked away, literally and figuratively, including by our own devices on which we become so dependent. Right. So all the poem says, that the title's the best part, and it's not my own. I mean, I took that from something. And all the poem says is, sorry to be the one to tell you, but your emotions have been hacked.
I mean, it's great. It's great.
yeah, and another poem is called Another Long Poem, because I do write long poems. And then, you know, there's a fatigue that sets in. You know, even at a reading where people say, I'm going to read this poem, it's kind of long. And everybody goes, oh, God. You know, so I said, well, I'll write another long poem. So this is called Another Long Poem. The telltale heart is mine. You know, the ground poem,
like,
right?
Words.
Yeah. And then there's my poem after Rilke, since you asked, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the great word from Beowulf, you know, it's what? Like that H-W-A-E-T, that, you know, it's just an exclamation. That's a whole poem when it occurs, you know, and it's at the root of our own language, the English language, that Anglo-Saxon sort of terminology that is revivified in everything we do. So that's just the title, is that exclamation. I say the poem is after Rilke because the poem says in two lines this: who among the angels would hear me if I started screaming my head off? You know, so
that's,
I sort of
updating.
Do the right. I take Rilke, and it's like, if Rilke could cut to the chase, that's what it would maybe boil down to.
Right.
But
you know, this is a game that we used to play, and when I was in graduate school, we would take like great, like, novels, these epic novels, and tell them in one sentence, you know, and it was always,
right,
it's hilarious, you know, and you can do it. You can kind of tell the gist,
right,
of the novel in one sentence.
But it's serious, too, because you get back to the elementals.
Exactly.
I mean, the sort of, you know, the passion, the compression of the passion in Rilke is what grabs us. I mean, everybody says, when you say Rilke, the knee-jerk response is, you must change your life. It's as if, you know, like, if I could write a poem, it would be, you must change your life. You know, of course, in the original German, right?
Yeah.
So there, too, it's like how to absorb Beowulf and the classics and Rilke and all the stuff that we just all talk about as poets in our time, even in our culture. I thought, what does it boil down to? And again, that language of stressfulness, to even domestic stressfulness or political stress, mm-hmm, that our colleagues experience every day, walking around in this fraught and vicious and murderous culture. Mm-hmm. You want to scream your head off. Mm-hmm. But the question is, if you do, will somebody hear you? Will the angels hear you? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And then what? You know, if the angels hear us, then what? Mm-hmm. The great unanswered questions of poetry. And I thought, I don't need to say more in the poem.
Right. It's all there.
It's there somehow.
Well, I feel like I've done something kind of funny to you by picking these poems that you never expected. Do you want to read one that you would have chosen?
Oh, God. I suppose so, because, you know, I don't want to give a false impression, you know, that I am, you know, sort of jokey or something like that. And I suppose I do have poems. I think the long ones are kind of good, but I'll spare you and everybody else.
The long one of my favorite ones is, I think I'm trying to remember the title. I think it was Murder. Just
yeah.
That was, and it's very long, but it was definitely, I think it might have been my favorite in the collection.
Well, so some poems, you know, you read, you know, like if you read Goblin Market, you can read it out loud or you can read it sitting down. And I think poems have an obligation to sort of gravitate to their best kind of presentation. And some poems, I feel like you want to sit and read.
Exactly.
Like, novels are long and we read them. And then some poems, you know, you don't want that experience when you're listening to them. So I seldom read really long poems because you hear the chairs squeaking and
not great.
So this is sort of a very conventional, you know, most contemporary American poems are, you know, they take up like 3/4 of one page and that's it. That's kind of our unit of measurement, generally speaking, for the average poem. So this is an average, you know, poem of mine. And it's called Looking Over My Shoulder. Again, it's the thing we inherit about where, you know, Lot's wife turns around and there's the pillar of salt. I mean, everybody knows that. It almost loses meaning because we know it so well. So I was thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, in Eliot's tradition in The Individual Talent, it's the same thing where he says that there are all these poets sort of hovering over our shoulders and we have to sort of look behind them to see where our individual work fits in. So it's sort of a comic situation we've been put in by both the Bible and T.S. Eliot, that there's all these people behind us that we're beholden to with real power, not just ghosts. But then on a more prosaic level, I was thinking of poor Alex Chilton. I'm from Memphis and I write a lot about Memphis stuff, and Alex, great Memphis musician, died having a heart attack while mowing the lawn, and I thought that's the worst way to go. I mean, nobody wants to go that way, and I thought that's real punishment from up above to go that way. His last words, I believe, were to his wife in the car. He said, "Run the red light," which was beautiful to me poem. I mean, it's tragic. I'm not making light of it. Yeah. Very powerful things you say under duress, and we are under duress, all of us, if not now, soon, if not sooner than before. And then, too, I was often thinking the domestic life I was describing that sort of sucks up so much of the resources, the world involved people doing things like mowing the lawn in the first place. Why do we have lawns? Why do we mow them? Who puts water on them? What's going on? Right. Maybe a domestic life should be punished. Mm-hmm. So this takes all of that together, and the poem doesn't even go on as long as that. But the question is, when you know, if you die and you meet, say, God, and he asks you something, he meets with you. This is about a meeting with God. The ultimate punishment, if we were bad enough, if there is a hell to which we are sent, it would be to be sent back to earth, you know, to resume our sort of futile, horror-driven, squandering lives. So this sort of takes all of the stuff I just said and sort of compresses it into this called Looking Over My Shoulder. Okay, here goes. Looking over my shoulder. I went to heaven once, sadly leaving my push mower and orange snow shovel behind, like uneaten food pushed aside on a stark china plate. The man upstairs was not happy. He liked a sharp blade and a clear driveway. His strictures were stringent enough to shrive a cactus. Yet it was I who blindly insisted on formalities and stood on what I thought was ceremony. I could scarcely taste the beer he poured or eat my ham sandwich. When our visit was over, he shook my hand and sent me somersaulting back to my village, where I was filled, thank God, with genuine salt. So I could picture, God is shaking hands. He's being the perfect host, and he serves me lunch and, something to drink. And then, boom, somersaulting back, sort of like Chagall in reverse. I go back to my, sort of cruddy life and have to start, resume the chores again.
It's a new horror genre poem.
I like that. It really is. I was sort of hoping it would take off.
I really like the details in it too. You know, the very like human. You're up there talking to God, but like, you know, where's my ham sandwich?
It seems glib, but I feel like this is very serious. It's like if you really sort of try to imagine what a meeting like that would be like. Mm-hmm. I mean, what use would he have for the likes of me? You know, it would be like he'd look at his watch and get out of here.
Well,
I have stuff to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I was saying earlier. I mean, it's, I don't take any of your work as glib at all. And that's exactly what I meant when I was talking about like the meditation bell or the koan. It literally, it feels like there's this pop, and it could be humor. You know, it's something that just awakens the reader into the poem. But then it's that, you know, that seriousness that kind of lingers with you. You
realize, yeah.
But that's how like really great humor is anyway, right?
I think so. I'll tell you how I arrived at the kind of mission, for better or worse, of doing things in this way was, I mean, the truth is, when it comes to poetry, I'm very, very serious. I'm like an introverted, serious poetry guy. I'm a bookish guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I just read. I sort of live inside my thoughts and my mind. And I have to remind myself to go out in the world and do something useful. You know, I think a lot of us, right?
Yeah.
Well, one time, some of the poems that went into Squandermania, which was my second book, I was reading them out loud before there was any kind of manuscript or anything. I just had these poems, and I was reading them at a bookstore in Amherst, and I thought they were very angry poems. It was around 9/11, mm-hmm. and things were really, you know, just sort of the surreal politics that we were experiencing of that, mm-hmm. and the fear and the uncertainty and all kinds of things that were going through our lives at that time. I didn't know how to write about anything, let alone that. I didn't know how to write about anything anymore. I was at a loss. And I realized that there was so much for us all, everywhere in the world, to be angry about. And this was, on the one hand, a kind of, for many people, righteous anger, but also a destructive anger. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know what to do. So I wrote things, and I felt they were very serious poems, mm-hmm. and contained a kind of anger language, as I call it somewhere else. And I read them at this reading, and people were laughing. And I looked up and I thought, why are people laughing? I'm very serious, you know? And then I realized there is a comedy in it. There's a pathos and a comedy at the same time that come together. There's no tearing them apart. I mean, at moments of extremity, I think people survive by laughing.
Yes.
We ran a piece in poetry that Tom Slay wrote, where he was visiting camps where the United Nations was feeding starving people. Mm. And he said, when people are starving and you give them, they have these things you can feed people. They have glucose in them. It gets your jumpstarts the metabolism. Mm. He says, the first thing that happens when people start to be human again after starving is they play. They laugh.
Oh, wow.
You wouldn't expect it, but that's mm-hmm. what he has witnessed. And so what I realized was that as any comedian would tell you, but poets are sort of struggling with it, the seriousness is a kind of comedy. I mean, that's when, you know, when we talk about Dante's comedy, it's not jokes. They're not jokes. I mean, it's very serious. But that word comedy encompasses a wide range of things besides being sort of self-important and serious and oracular. It has to accommodate the humiliations that we experience, which are quite funny. I mean, as I grow older and experience the depredations that set in, you have to laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I'm hearing impaired, I have problems. And I hear funny things. They're not what people say, but the way I hear them makes me smile. You know, and I feel like this is an acclimation that kind of laughter, if we can manage it, accomplishes our process of acclimation to difficult circumstances and living under duress, even if we're lucky enough to experience no more than the duress of growing old, you know, in an affluent culture.
Yeah.
The worst and the best things we could ever imagine are sort of funny serious and serious funny.
Yeah. I'm amazed that you and I are actually carrying on a conversation, because I don't really hear the best either. I wonder if we're even talking about the same thing. But, you know, speaking of mishearing, I actually misread something that was kind of funny for me. It was a review of, I think it was Wishbone, and it was from Publishers Weekly. And they
I know.
It was really good. They said that your work sort of presented a kind of like cosmic desperation. And when I first read it, I thought it said comic desperation for some reason. And then I sort of stepped back for a minute and thought about it, and I was like, they're both true.
They really are. That was the part of the review I liked. I think there was another part of it. It's funny how these things stick with you, because I was so crushed when it came out, because that was a nice thing to say. And I aspired to that. Yeah. But I think it also said something like, I use bad words in my poems, which really struck me because I didn't think of it that way. You know, it said something about scatological stuff. And I was like, what? I had to go back and
so
I looked
you
and I thought, well, sure enough.
As an insult?
Well, no, I just thought, that's not how I would characterize what I'm trying to do. I think when we all speak like normal people, we use a kind of salty vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to sound, to be serious for a second here, I was trying to sound like a human being. I was trying to sound like a person, like a regular person. We do use that kind of scatological thing all day long. You know, something goes wrong, you go, shit, you know. And to me, that's not scatological. That is logical. I mean, that's just how it works.
Scatological is Jonathan Swift and Winningham's throwing stuff out
true.
Of trees.
That's true. I'll look at it that way. What I thought the review was going to do was sort of scare off people or really make it sound puerile, because there is an aspect to comedy that, you know, like a cheapness or a shallowness. Mm-hmm. And I was working very hard not to be cheap and shallow, though I'm perfectly capable of it.
Right.
You know, and often accomplish it in drafts. But, you know, I was really, again, trying to do something that I thought was very challenging, and I was taken aback. And when that review happened, I thought, oh, great, you know, no one's going to want to read this book
That's
now.
That's so funny. I guess, you know, the way we have a tendency to criticize ourselves more than someone else might.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I don't remember thinking that review was negative. I mean,
well, yeah, you're right.
That
we look for the negative
parts. I was like,
parts.
Oh, it's scatological. Yeah. Okay, you know. In my family, you know, we like fart jokes. And, you know, it's a good thing.
No, it's a good thing. Just to be clear, I have no fart jokes in any of my poems. But maybe I'll take that on someday for sure.
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, I actually didn't notice anything scatological about the book at all. Not at
well,
all.
You know, we poets are very, you know, we're oversensitive souls. We're easy to hurt, and we're shrinking all the time from what people might say.
Did you see the there was a I don't know who you follow on Twitter, but Alex Dimitrov.
Yes.
he sent out a tweet the other day that said, I got a paper cut and thought that I was dying, so I texted like three of my poet friends, and they were all dying too.
Yes, it's beautiful. I mean, that's the world in a grain of sand,
it
right?
Is.
I mean, you know, I mean, I think there's a serious aspect to it that the images we see, which are real of the world and all the bloody violence and horrors of it, I mean, it starts with a cut. I mean, we're done to death by many cuts, as it were, And I think, you know, we try so hard to avoid them when it is unavoidable. I mean, most of us are so much more sheltered and privileged than other people can be. But I think, you know, again, Alex finding the comedy in that is a serious thing. Mm-hmm. It's like the empathy begins with a silly thing. If I'm taken aback by a drop of blood on my own finger, that is nothing. It's harmless. Mm-hmm. Then you multiply that many thousands of times over to know what it is like to see somebody lose their bodies, lose their lives, mm-hmm. as we are witnesses to around the clock. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start with something to get into things that otherwise we shrink from, hide from, avoid, are in denial about. I think you have to confront everything, including the superficial things, mm-hmm. because we have to understand how the superficial works to shield us from what's really important.
Well, I do want to say, I mean, I never thought of anything in your poem, and I'm kind of trying to think of something that I want to say at the same time as I'm saying this, but I never thought of anything in there as being superficial or scatological or silly or mm-hmm. anything like that. I mean, it all had a serious sort of, you know, it led to somewhere serious, just like what we were talking about with Alex. But I'm thinking in particular of one of your poems that I think kind of represents for me, in a way, what you're doing with your work overall. And it's that poem that takes lines from Dante's Purgatory. And
yeah, lines, and Southern Living.
Southern Living. And it weaves them into a poem. And it's like, here we have these two things that are, you know, totally in different realms of experience, but they're all our experience. I mean, they're all being human, right? So, but in a larger sense, I mean, that poem sort of crystallizes what's going on, but in a larger sense, to me, that's what your poetry is doing. It's taking, you know, it's like anything within the realm of human experience goes in there and gets sometimes laughed at, sometimes seriously considered. And to me, that's kind of a wonderful thing, because back when I was first applying to go to graduate school, I think I didn't really I mean, I came from having an MA in literature to going to an MFA in poetry. And in between those steps, I had been reading mostly, you know, the dead poets.
Right.
So
yeah.
It didn't occur to me that, oh, you can actually write about this. So that's been a really liberating thing for me. And I think your poetry does that. Your poetry opens that up.
Well, I think we have to confront what's actually around us. And some things are very big, you know, and poets want to write about big things, and they're necessary. But at the same time, you can't deny the reality that consists of the environment that surrounds us and the figures of speech used in a lifestyle magazine when it comes to food or animals or gardening. Are not far from the tortures that we read about in Dante. I mean, right. It's amazing to me that the language bends towards either kind of use. In other words, gluttony is a theme that's in Dante, obviously, and much else besides. And yet so much of our life, without thinking about it, is devoted, if we're, again, affluent, you know, North Americans or Europeans, it's kind of on that level. It's like we want, you know, we want to talk about food. It's sort of a sin, isn't it? I mean, and yet it's necessary. We need and want to be nourished, and we want to experience pleasure while we can, and if we're fortunate enough to. I mean, so to deny either end of the spectrum of possible outcomes day to day in our lives would be false, you know? So for me, it was a way of saying there's a language in these magazines that are floating around, which has to be understood as being related somehow or other to the language of even the greatest poetry. These are coexisting all the time, and to pretend otherwise is false and introduces obstacles to sort of perception or useful perception. Just trying to keep things straight, you know. If I say I'm a poet, which I almost never do, I can't mean by that I'm somebody who is unaware of these other uses of language that are kind of emptied out.
Right.
And our job is to fill them back up. So I try to pay attention to all kinds of language, as we all do, not just literature, but the language that engages us like 90% of the rest of our time.
Right.
It's there. It's ours. We need to sort of redeem it, make it work for something good.
You've got me thinking about, with the different kinds of language, this is just going off now, but you would be in a better position to know this than almost anybody I could think of to talk to. Who reads poetry?
Magazine
and poetry in general, like other than poets.
We get so hung up on stuff like this, and the media then does too, and it to me is a terrible distraction. Like for Poetry Magazine, we did some surveys to understand our own audience better a few years ago. And more than half of our readers have no advanced degree past high school. They are general readers, sophisticated people who want to read challenging contemporary poetry every month. So that's our audience. The thing is, they don't blog. They don't, you know, they don't weigh in on poetry. They don't tweet about poetry. They don't write letters to editors of poetry magazines. They don't, they get it. Mm-hmm. And they're there for us. And we should never neglect our understanding that our audience is what we would wish it to be. Mm-hmm. Now we just need to say something to them in the best way we can think of. Right. At the same time, people worry about, oh, is poetry just for other poets? Well, it would be weird if poetry were not also for poets, you know?
Right.
So they're both audiences. They're sort of coming at it in different ways and for probably different reasons, but they're both out there. I mean, there wouldn't be a poetry magazine if nobody was reading it. Mm-hmm. When we put, to put it in perspective, a poem like Dennis Smith, you know, the alternate names for black boys will get 8,000 to 12,000 hits a day on the foundation website.
Wow.
So if you think your poems aren't reaching a real audience and talking to people and meaning something to them, that's a number that's not just unique to that poem and that poet. Many of our poems, day after day, are doing something for many, many thousands and thousands of readers. It's unbelievable. You know, nobody dreams of this, but it's true. And if you think like a, like going back to our origins, say a poem like Proof Rock, when it was published in poetry, the maximum number of readers it would have had would have been in the hundreds, because that's about how many people subscribe to that magazine. No internet, no other media, just a print magazine, very small. Well, now that poem, in its afterlife, if you want to call it that, has had millions of readers. Mm-hmm. How do you explain this? So a poem has a life, and a poem lives on. And not only in its contemporary moment it will it reach many tens of thousands of people who want to read poems. If it holds up for some unaccountable, unignorable reason, it will have millions of readers for ages untold as time unfolds. That's a remarkable thing. I think poets often have the idea like no one's paying attention, no one cares. You always hear this, the stakes are so low, that's why we fight with each other. But on the contrary, the stakes are very high because people are waiting to see and hear what we can do. They need and want it. There is an audience for it, but you can't count them. The statistics you see, you know, from say the NEA, how do you count people who read a poem? It's unlike other activities. You know how many people like sports and you know, do certain things. The only thing poetry readers have in common with other poetry readers is that they read poems. Everything else is different. Level of education, class, demographic, zip code, all of those things. They're not concentrated in any one kind of place. They're everywhere. I hear when we publish an issue and it goes online, I see and hear things from people all over the planet instantly. And then even now people will go, you know, you can see on Twitter or elsewhere, and that's the tip of an iceberg. Somebody discovering a poem that was published, you know, a year ago, 5 years ago, 50 years ago. That poem is read anew, and then it's shared with people. So the audience for poetry has, in my view, never been better. There's never been so many easy, wonderful ways to find poems, to come across them, to share them with people if you care about the thing you've just experienced in a poem. So we live in great times for poetry. If people don't believe that, then I worry that underestimating the audience will cause them to knock the bar down lower in their own work.
Well,
I think everything depends on it.
Now.
You know, it's a humbling thing to see how many people really are there to read the work that poets do.
Wonderful. Just wonderful. Do you notice anything in common between or among the poets or the poems that are getting so many hits at the website?
Well, there's sort of a, I mean, I guess the long tail as a phenomenon has been more or less discredited in some ways. But if you think of it this way, Proof Rock and those kinds of poems are always at the top because the readership just snowballs. It grows and grows and grows. But that's because that poem had 100 years in which that phenomenon could take place.
Right.
A poem that was written and published within the last year or two is going to need a good long time to acquire its ultimate readership, if it does. And that's a complex process. In other words, how many people were reading Emily Dickinson's poems in the 19th century? Well, a handful. Maybe you can count them on one, maybe two hands at the most. Now it's in the millions, so we don't know how to account for it. So you can never tell. Mm-hmm. To answer the question in a more practical sense, sometimes you see recent poems sort of climb up that list. Often they are poems that speak to what is happening, speak mm-hmm. to the news, speak mm-hmm. to things people are coping with, mm-hmm. like police violence and other kinds of things that are literally in the news day after day, mm-hmm. poems that speak to that. People are looking, what can the poets tell me about this? People need and want it, and they find it. Other poems are poems that just sort of always manage to strike a chord and sound good. There's something about the sound of a poem. But in a way, if you had to sort of find out what these poems have in common, is that they are unignorable. I mean, even poems by neglected poems will come back to life if there's something about the poet's work which is unignorable. It may not find an audience in its own time, mm-hmm. but if it's unignorable, then it will come back for mm-hmm. sure. We see that all the time, people rediscovering poets mm-hmm. or poems, and that's how that works. Mm-hmm. You couldn't predict it in advance. So that, for instance, in Harriet's, you know, objectivist issue with Zhukovsky, you know, there were no objectivists, right? I don't think anybody knew what poems that were being published were going to hold up and which ones were not. In Harriet's first issue in 1912, she had Ezra Pound, Arthur Davison Ficke, and William Vaughan Moody. Now those last two poets were they were big poets in their time. Now nobody, I suppose, really reads them, and it was Pound, but Pound was nobody really.
That's
so you can't account for it, you know, but there it is. I don't think anybody knows which poems, in other words, will rise to the top of that list where people just read and read and read them. But rise they do.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I have a couple of final questions for you. My producer, RJ Jeffries, wants me to ask you what in the world has happened to rhyme and couplets and sonnets, and he's...
Nothing. They're still there. People write sonnets, right? I mean, sonnets are a contemporary form that's still very much alive. People push the envelope. We talked about Sandra Symonds has done them, and you know, Berrigan. I mean, sonnets are always with us. Rhyme is always with us. Poets use rhyme. They may not use it the way other people did 100 years ago, but why would they? Why would poets today do something that people did the same way among themselves 100, 200, 300 years ago? Mm-hmm. Now, that question is often misunderstood, because I would say that the history of rhyme is recent. Mm-hmm. In other words, the poets of antiquity, the Greek and Latin poets, did not have rhyme and did not use rhyme. They didn't need it. They were inflected languages and used other devices. Biblical poetry has no rhyme. So that kind of poetry from antiquity there was no rhyme in it. Mm-hmm. We see rhyme start to, I'm not a scholar or historian as such, but very broadly speaking, you start to see the rise of rhyme between say 400 and 700. You know, when with the troubadours and other developments in Europe, you see rhyme happen. But in other languages, there isn't necessarily rhyme or anything like it. So rhyme in sort of European languages arises, you could say, relatively recently and had a heyday that ran from the time of the troubadours up through the early 20th century, probably well into the mid-20th century. And at that moment, things shift around, as inevitably they must, where people find other devices to use for poetry. But rhyme hasn't gone anywhere. It's just that we have so much of it in our literary back, mm-hmm. sort of back, the back run of poems to which we always have access. We don't need to write, like, say, Frost or you know, poets of the 19th and 18th century. We don't need to do that because they did it. I often think poets do things so that other people don't have to. I mean, you know, like Emily Dickinson was Emily Dickinson so that we don't have to be. Aww. You know, any poet would be like that. I mean, Eliot did Eliot's thing, so now nobody else has to do that. We have to do something else. What is that?
Right.
That said, there's probably a pendulum swing. I think all poets are tempted to try rhyme and they go back to it. But so it hasn't really gone anywhere. It's there. You can find a rhyming poet like that. A rhyming poem. Anytime you need one, there's one there. People do still write them. But they played out in a certain sense. That was a kind of device or tradition that in many ways kind of exhausted itself and ran a natural course and never quite vanished and will probably come back when people get tired of what we call free verse that we all write or other kinds of things. They come and go. In the longer scheme of things, rhyme is just fine. Right. But it's not all there is to poetry either. So when you go to, if somebody goes to school and they learn that the definition of poetry is that it rhymes, you have left out 90% or 95% of all the poetry in all the cultures of the world that was ever composed.
Wow.
Most of it had nothing to do with rhyme, but a lot of it in our English language tradition does, and it's available to us.
Great, thank you. And I wanted to ask you also, I think that people are a little confused, or at least, I'm a little confused about Poetry Magazine, the Poetry Foundation, the Harriet blog. Could you sort of explain how all of that functions and what the interrelationships are?
I can try, you know, and I think people might bear in mind that it's the both the organization and all the pieces of it are in transition now.
Okay.
And when there's a new president on board, I think a lot of that stuff is going to change.
Okay.
I think there's a historical explanation, which is that when the Poetry Foundation was kind of invented or created, people had to figure out what it would be, what it would do.
Mm-hmm.
They had to think, we should have a website. There wasn't one, you know, that does what we have now. The magazine was there, but what other programs were there? And there were things like Poetry Out Loud, which is a successful program, and other, you know, sort of programs that we have. And basically, I work on the magazine, you know, and my colleagues at the foundation do other stuff, and I'm not always necessarily... I don't work on, say, the website. I don't have editorial input into it. It's independent of the magazine, and the magazine is independent in the sense of that, that we're all kind of working under the same roof and trying to accomplish certain things that are related to the mission of the foundation. So that my responsibility, my role is to be the editor of the magazine, which involves putting a lot of what we have online and in digital form, so it's there. So it's not just a print thing. But I don't work on Harriet. I don't work on editorial pieces that were not in the magazine that do appear on the site. And often I read them like everybody else. I look there. Or, you know, sometimes I obviously will know that people are working on various things, but it's not my role to sort of pay a whole lot of attention to them unless these things sort of come together in organic ways where we can help each other. And I think we'd like to do more of that. So, but for now, the web team does the web stuff, and the, you know, there are events, and I don't do programming. I don't put on, you know, my events, particularly if there are events at the Poetry Foundation. There are people who are responsible for creating programming, and they do that. And so we all do sort of different things that clearly do intersect in many ways. You know, often I, you know, people will ask me about something someone else is doing at the foundation, and I, you know, and I go find out about it and, you know, relay messages, which I'm happy to do. If somebody has a question about why a poem is or isn't on the site, I relay it to the people who work on that. And then they may hear things about the magazine that they tell me, you know, that they hear that I don't hear directly. So in a way, we're kind of all doing our own thing. And we're trying more to see how to coordinate all that better, to make things work together better, to work from all the strengths that we might all contribute, and sort of make that kind of a more robust and sort of power, you know, sort of resonant kind of activity. But it was born out of constituent parts. If there was a website, people had to figure out how to make that happen, how to get poems that went on the website, and how to get learning resources and poem guides, you know, and that stuff that other people do. The people who do that don't, like, tell me what to put in the magazine. So it's kind of like that. We're all beavering away at the stuff we are tasked to do and doing the best we can.
Okay, thanks. That helps a lot. I wanted to ask you, this is my second to last question. Do you have any recommendations for Vida as we proceed forward, deepening the conversation and looking at various publications and the work that they put into the world?
Well, I know there's no shortage of advice for people who do the kind of work that you do, just like there's no shortage of advice for people who do what I do. I think, you know, you're headed obviously in the direction we need you to go, which is to account for other kinds of balance and diversity. I mean, that's a big thing to do, and it's hard to know exactly how to go about it. And then, you know, I think there'll have to be a lot of discussions so that we all understand what the metrics are or should be for that, mm-hmm. what the goals are, how people arrive at those goals, and how people can reach them. You know, a lot of this is going, you know, to have to be worked out, but I'm glad that VIDA is working on that, because when it started, gender diversity was clearly, as it still is, a pressing issue. But we see that there are so many other things mm-hmm. that we're responsible to do, and having somebody sort of track things for us is very valuable. And you guys are in a position to do it in a way that I'm not. I don't know if I'm allowed to ask people how they identify. You know, right. You can't, when I read submissions, I don't know always who people are or what their name might mean mm-hmm. or where people are coming from or how they, you know, it's not always clear if they don't tell you. And so, you know, for you guys to do the work, the tab, you know, we could have like a questionnaire. So every time you submit, you check a box. We right. have felt in the past that that would be intrusive and right. that if not everyone did it, it would be skewed. But maybe we ought to do that. So what I'm grateful for is that VIDA is undertaking these sort of hard questions and figuring out how to move forward to make all this stuff better.
Yeah, you know, you just made me realize something that I guess should have been self-evident, which is that you wouldn't know. How could you? So maybe when you see, like, the women of color count, for instance, that might be a surprise to you.
And you know, obviously I know a lot of people and I meet a lot of people and I watch a lot of people's work and want mm-hmm. them to send work to poetry and all that. So, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, you do know. Mm-hmm. But because we live for the work of discovery, mm-hmm. to find a poet we've never known, never heard of, a name that doesn't ring a bell, to find, you know, someone who might have been under the radar or kept out of magazines, to look specifically for those people mm-hmm. Who are there sending work, means that you don't always know about who the submitter is.
Right.
And with luck, you may meet them. Like, you know, I meet a lot of people at AWP that I've only known through their work or mm-hmm. through the submissions. But a name alone isn't enough. A cover letter or the little thing in Submittable isn't enough for somebody to say who they are. Or what they want to self-identify with. See, very few people explain anything about self-identification in cover letters, though I've encouraged people to if they want to and feel comfortable with it. So now, thanks to our AWP panel on disability and poetry, you know, poets are saying, you know, that they have disabilities, and that is a meaningful thing if they choose to share it. It does say something about, you know, what's at stake in the submission mm-hmm. and so on down the line. But you can't, you know, you would never, I can't quite grasp that you would require people to do that.
No.
You know, it doesn't seem right at all.
Well, and it could
so be. How would you know who the submitter is if you didn't already know who they were?
Right, right. Okay, that's something to really think about. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so my final question. I think I read recently that you signed a book contract with the University of Chicago
yes.
Press.
Yeah.
And that's going to be your 13th book, right?
I lost track a little bit, and it depends on if you count ebooks, which I should.
And I did.
Yes, well, in that case, I think you're right.
Okay. So well, can you tell us about that and also about anything else in your creative work, your editorial work, just anything that's
sure.
forthcoming that you're excited
sure.
about?
Yeah, as far as the book goes, we don't know the title yet, but what it's going to do is collect these quirky view from here pieces that we've had over the years where people who are not sort of poetry people talk about their experience of poetry. We've had everybody from, you know, Nico Case down to, you know, people who weld bridges, marine biologists, people from all walks of life. We had an installment in the summer issue that had Ai Weiwei talking about what poetry meant to him in his family. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is collect those and try to put them together in a kind of sequence or structure. I think it'll be a very interesting book. What it will do is build a bridge from we were talking about this before, about the kinds of people who read poetry that we don't know about.
These
works represent that very kind of reader. And what I hope the book will do is connect those of us who are sort of poetry people with the kind of reader who doesn't know about all the ins and outs and POBIS, as we call it. And, you know, they're readers, but it will show you what poems, what our work means to those readers.
It
comes from that rubric, the view from here, which is, sounds kind of funny, so we probably won't call it that. And it'll be sort of a companion book to the book I edited with Christian Wiman, The Open Door, which was really not like poetry's greatest hits or anything.
No.
It was just sort of a sequence of poems that we put together that he and I both could live with that we thought would be interesting to readers. That's a funny book because it sells really well.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of money, and I don't earn any money from these books. I work for a nonprofit.
Oh.
It would not be appropriate for me. So the books that I'm involved with that sell the best, I do not. It's like totally, I'm pure, I'm clean. I get no money for that work. It goes to help, you know, keep us in the work that we do, you know, sort of at the nonprofit. So I hope this one will be like The Open Door, a bestseller. But I won't, you know, I don't plan to earn a penny from it. It's all, you know, for
well, I
wish poetry and its readers.
I wish you were earning money because clearly I think you need some more albums.
Right, yeah.
And no, some more poetry books, too.
Well, I'm lucky because one of the great lucky things about doing the kind of work I do is people send me their books. And you know, I do buy books, by the way. We get sent review copies and stuff, but I'm a big book buyer. I could show you, I have... from wall to the ceiling, I have a zillion books here. Anyone who's visited my office sees they're weighing down the shelves and they're about to break. I buy books because I put my money where my sort of eyeballs are.
Mm-hmm.
If I like a poet's work, I buy their books because
me
it
too.
Means so much, not just to the poet, but to the presses that try so hard to put work out there.
Me too.
Obviously, right. The magazine is fortunate,
right.
And we can afford to do a lot of stuff.
Right.
And our job, so that you understand and everybody understands what we do, is we basically distribute Ruth Lilly's generous bequest to poets. We pay poets. When their poems are on the website, people are paid, and that's what we do. We're redistributing the wealth. This is what she intended for us to do, these programs, but also to make sure that poets, you know, get something for their work.
Mm-hmm.
But I buy books because I believe in that. And if we aren't buying each other's books, then the whole system falls apart.
That's right.
I think the thing that you asked, though, about what people should know very generally, I think about this a lot in terms of some of the controversies that go on,
mm-hmm.
like regularly now, which to me are necessary and heartbreaking and infuriating for everybody at the same time. What I wish for is that people would understand that editors, whether it's me or somebody, you know, editing the best American poetry, whatever it is, in my experience, editors are always reading work with goodwill and good faith and good intentions. And they don't just get those good intentions. They don't just pave the road to hell, you know, they do that. But people are reading work in good faith when they could be doing something else to benefit perhaps their own careers.
Mm-hmm.
And they do so willingly. It's not a sacrifice. We all do it because we choose to do it and we're lucky mm-hmm. to do it. What I would hope too is that the good faith is communicable and that there's a person on the other end. Like I said, I read almost all the poems that come to us. If I don't, Christina does, and then she shares them with me. And I wish people would understand I'm a person. I'm at the other end of what, when you say things about my work
mm-hmm.
or about the magazine, I'm a person and my staff, they're people too. And we care very deeply about what we do. We make mistakes. We do stuff that we wish we hadn't and all that. But we're people and we live to be educated and to learn from you as well as from the poems that we read. And I hope too that the goodwill can be shared. When people send us work, they should do so in good faith too. You know, the controversy about using another kind of identity or name is not a good faith thing to do. If you send poems, the editor only has what you send to go by usually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need your good faith and goodwill. And I think if we all keep that going, it doesn't preclude calling people out for their misjudgments and mistakes or if they do crass or unjust things. We do need to be called out. But on balance, what you would wish for is a kind of generosity of spirit,
mm-hmm.
even under duress, even when things are bad, that if we could all sort of have at the base of all of our kind of communications among ourselves about what we do, I think so much more would change than when we pile on and, you know, sort of exercise our great capacity for being articulate in angry terms. We do. Anger is very important, and people need to be heard. But you should understand that people do hear you, mm-hmm. that people are listening. I am listening. Mm-hmm. I've talked a lot during this interview, but I'm not here to do any kind of mansplaining, editor-splaining, or white person-splaining thing. I mean, most of my job consists of listening and reading and thinking about what people are trying to say. Mm-hmm. And I know that's true of all the people who do the work that I do and that do the works that Invita is doing. Mm-hmm. And I think people should understand that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think that will mean a lot to a lot of people, because I think that, I know when I first started sending poems out, I didn't think a lot about the person on the other end. And now I teach my students, you know, these people, they're people, they're overwhelmed, you know. I talk to them about how to handle that. And I think it is important. To recognize that you're not sending it to a computer,
right? It's a bit bucket, as they used to say. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So thank you for saying that, and I think that that will also go a long way towards what you were saying about making people feel welcome. So.
Yes, I think people are really welcome. It's true that editors pick and choose. And work that I don't take for poetry, mm-hmm. I know that good work will find a home and it will find readers. I believe that, and I see that happen. If it isn't with us, it will be with somebody else. And you need that faith, and I feel like that is so important to remember. It can be hard because we all experience terrible disappointments and setbacks, mm-hmm. but you can remind yourself. The people are very careful in my experience. Mm-hmm. We don't use the term in poetry. I've never heard anybody, I've been here 8 years now total, and now I'm the editor. I never heard anybody use the word slush, not once. Mm-hmm. I never heard anybody at Poetry Magazine use that word.
That's nice.
You know, we care about every submission and what people think and what people say, and we hear you. I mean, you don't always have the opportunity to say what I've just said one to one. Yeah. But yes, people are welcome. We hear you and we care. And it means the world to us. We would have no magazine without the time and care that people take to send their work. Mm-hmm. And it's so important. And that's true at every other magazine or book publisher, anybody you encounter. That's why they're there. They want to see what you're doing, even if it doesn't work out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful note to end on. We hear you.
Great. Yes, we hear you.
We hear you and we care. I love that.
We do.
Okay. Well, it's just been wonderful, wonderful talking to you.
Thank you. Same here. I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah,
I mean, now we have to go hang out at AWP or something, because these conversations are wonderful to have for
absolutely.
Everyone.
I would love that. So, and that's just... It'll be here before we know it.
Yeah. Yes.
So, okay, great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you then at AWP, if not before. And, okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Night.
Good night.
Bye.